Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 14th of September, 2022, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, brought to you by the Construction Index. And having been on holiday for the past 2 weeks, Phil, I'm a bit out of the loop, so I'm not really sure what we're going to talk about today. Not much has happened over the last week or so, I understand.
It has been a momentous past couple of weeks on a much lesser scale of things. We've had a change of government, which in any other podcast episode that we present would be our lead topic, I'm sure. But, of course, the nation is mourning the death of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. And it brings about all kinds of feelings. Obviously, there was enormous sadness. I had slight prickly eyes when I heard the news. But on, you know, after a few days reflection, I kind of think that it couldn't have happened better. She was 96 years old. She was on her feet the 1 or 2 days before, I was going to say, inducting, whatever you do to a new prime minister, sort of getting Liz, accepting Liz Truss into the job of new prime minister. And yes, she'd had mobility problems for the past, possibly even a year or so. And we'd occasionally seen King Charles now is stand in. But for her to live to 96 and to be pretty much fit as a fiddle, almost, relatively speaking, to the end, you couldn't have asked for anything better. No. I mean, we didn't want a monarch who was so infirm as to be unavailable and, you know, not able to do any work. I mean, it's remarkable that she did as much work as she did to such a ripe old age as she did. I don't know many people who would describe themselves as avowed monarchists with, you know, my mother aside, perhaps. And but on the whole, certainly people, you know, my age or younger, it's slightly take it or leave it attitude that it's, you know, wouldn't necessarily abolish them, but you wouldn't start from here. You wouldn't create a monarchy if you're setting up a new system of government. But better than having, you know, Tony Blair or David Attenborough or Cliff Richard, well, maybe not David Attenborough, but better than having the elected head of state presidential figure. And it kind of works in a strange way. But I think the feeling of the nation over the past week has been that gratitude for the fact that she did work so hard for so long, so effectively. I mean, the only time I recall there being widespread criticism of the Queen in my lifetime is after the death of Princess Diana, or she wasn't princess then, was she? But Diana, the ex-wife of Wales, now King Charles, his first wife. But she wasn't even Princess of Wales, I think, when she died, was she? I don't know what her title was at that point. But that, you know, there was a film made about the Helen Mirren's first outing on film as playing the Queen, about that episode of her life. And at the time, there's quite a lot of public criticism of her. But I think in the long run, she came out of it okay. And broadly speaking, she has been faultless for virtually the whole of her 70-year reign. She was. We have to learn to talk about it in the past tense, which is getting hard.
Indeed, indeed. It's you're right. I agree with you absolutely that, you know, we should all be that lucky to live to that age and to remain as active right up until the end. But I think it's fair to say that the national mood has been perhaps more deferential than I would have expected. I was listening to the radio this morning. There was a woman, an English woman, who now lives in New Zealand, who hopped on a plane as soon as she heard about it, and she's now sleeping in a sleeping bag in Whitehall so she can queue up for 30 hours to file past the Queen's coffin. You know, that's going a lot further than most people. But I think it's been quite remarkable how some people are mourning more than others, let us say. I mean, I think there's widespread respect and a lot of good things said about the Queen. Yesterday, even some Republicans in Northern Ireland were being remarkably polite about her, considering their normal political stance. So I think that actually we're beginning to see exactly the depth of the respect that people felt about her and the value that they attached to her reign. I think some people have perhaps gone over the top a bit. I mean, I was sort of bracing myself for the same sort of mawkish outpouring of grief that we saw when Princess Diana died, which was, of course, a very tragic event in contrast to the Queen's death. We haven't really seen that, but we've seen people going a little bit over the top, I think, perhaps overreacting. You drew my attention this morning, in fact, to this story in The Guardian, which I hadn't seen, about British Cycling, which had issued this sort of edict to members of the cycling fraternity saying that they shouldn't get on their bikes on Monday because it's the Queen's funeral, which led a lot of people to angrily respond, some of them saying that this was, you know, they're behaving like the Stasi. I mean, you know, one chap saying, you know, you mean I should drive to work instead of cycle like I normally do? But there are guidelines so that we can sort of show our respect and, you know, observe a period of mourning, which are far more sensible and acceptable to most people.
I was hoping you'd take the conversation in this direction, because this is what I want to talk about this morning. Having established that I have, you know, full respect and deference for the our late Queen and, you know, long live the King and all that good stuff, I'm fully on board with that. There seems to be, I mean, you talked about British Cycling saying,
yeah,
don't go on a bike because it's the Queen's funeral on Monday, which is palpably ridiculous. But it's been quite widespread. An awful lot of people are issuing instructions on how you're supposed to behave and what you're supposed, yeah, to do because a 96-year-old woman has died. And the theme of this podcast is supposed to be the week's news in the construction, yep, industry. So let's talk about specifically the construction industry. And the Construction Leadership Council, which is a forum of construction industry leaders and civil servants and a junior government minister, have issued guidance on how to behave, what to do, what construction industry protocol should be for marking the passing of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, and, yeah, what to do in, you know, on the funeral day and all this sort of stuff. And it feels like mission creep from the Construction Leadership Council to me. I'm not convinced that's what this organisation exists for. We've spoken a lot over the past couple of years about the good and important work it did on COVID guidance. I mean, you could say the death of a monarch is unprecedented for probably everyone working in the construction industry. I can't imagine there are many people working in the construction industry who were alive in 1951, 52. But I can understand that the guidance that was produced for the COVID protocols was needed. Do we shut sites? Do we not shut sites? How do we open sites and all of that stuff?
Well, because that affects everybody. That affects everybody's health.
Exactly. But now they've come out and saying, what should we do? As if somehow everyone in the construction, yeah, industry thinks, I don't know what I'm supposed to
do. Do what you
do.
Want to do. Yeah.
Wait, you just, you know, keep calm, carry on. Yeah. But the guidance for Construction Leadership Council, for example, is saying, all organisations should carefully review any communications and responses to media to ensure that they are appropriate and respectful. Well, yeah, it's taking the bleeding, obviously. You should always do that. You know, don't shoot from the hip and say stupid things about anything ever. And it goes on, official advice from Construction Leadership Council. Online communication channels can be used to reflect the demise of Her Majesty and participate in the period of national mourning. Organisations can acknowledge the mourning period by making changes to the homepage of their website, for example, with the use of black edging or black banners. Now, I'm not saying that that is bad advice, no, but...
Or do we need it from the CLC?
Do we need that advice? I mean
do we need it at all?
Do we need it at all? I mean, it's nannyism gone mad. It's And then it goes on, they go on to say, and they brought out separate guidance for companies working in London, basically saying, it's going to be blooming busy in London. There's going to be loads of people. You might have difficulty moving your trucks around around the bridges. Yeah.
I think it's common sense, isn't it? I mean, I think I agree with you. We shouldn't need to be told. I mean, there are things like things which are on the face of it quite wise advice. Like, for example, you know, if you're working on a construction project on the route of the from Buckingham Palace to Westminster, and you know the cortege will be going past, all that, you're not going to be banging away with a hydraulic hammer when everybody goes past. But I think anybody who did that would be doing it deliberately. I don't think that they would be doing it because they weren't aware that there was something else going on. So do they really need to be told?
But, you know, water mains can burst at the most inconvenient moments.
Yeah,
you know, there might need to be some drilling outside the Abbey on the day of the funeral. It might be unavoidable.
Well, you know, fingers crossed, hopefully that won't happen. But, I mean, we're talking about routine work, you know, scheduled work on projects. You know, don't, if you've got all the mourners and the Queen's coffin, sort of processing past your site, you know, just down tools until they've passed, and you know, leave a decent period between them passing and you actually picking up your tools again. I think that's fairly obvious.
And maybe take your hard hat off as the coffin goes by.
But then you see, I think, let me flip it the other way, because I think that some people, it's sort of measured advice, and it's like, you know, as you said, a statement of the bleeding obvious. We shouldn't need to be told. But some people, I think, have gone over the top. Look at the British Cycling Federation. Another one was Centre Parks. Did you hear about that?
Throwing everyone out for the day.
They wanted to evict all their guests on Monday because they wanted to all take the day off for the funeral. I think a lot of people have overreacted. So the CLC advice perhaps will help them to get things into perspective, you know, be respectful, don't make too much noise in inappropriate places, that kind of thing. Allow your staff to have time off if you can afford to do so, that sort of thing, and not go over the top and go full.
I'm not saying it's bad advice, and the CLC, fortunately, haven't said to everyone, you know, the construction industry will down tools and you must not do any work on Monday the 19th, on the day of the funeral. They haven't said that. They said it's a national bank holiday, but there's no statutory right to the day off for the workers. It's up to employers to decide whether employees have the day off. So Robert McAlpine have gone public and said, well, we're closing all our sites and offices as a sign of respect and to allow employees to pay their own respects. And I think if I was the boss of a construction firm, I would do the same. I think that's an appropriate thing to do. But of course, not all work can stop. There's an awful lot of stuff that goes on 24/7, as we saw through COVID. There are, you know, people who have to work through night and day, thick and thin, come what may. Some work that has to continue. So I'm glad that the Construction Leadership Council didn't say we authorise or we dictate that the industry has to stop working on the day of the funeral. But I just, even though what it said was broadly, some of it was trite, some of it was sensible, and it's broadly, you know, correct in to a greater or lesser extent, I'm just not sure that we need some quasi-semi-industry government body telling us what to do. I mean,
no,
it's just a step too far. Whether I'd feel differently if it was a trade association rather than this odd body that the TLC is, I'm not sure. And apropos nothing at all, absolutely no one on the Construction Leadership Council is elected there. They don't actually really represent anyone at all in any sort of democratic sense. Because even the minister who co-chairs it, the current one, even they are not elected by anyone. It's Lord Callanan who got the job because he had been a local government councillor for a number of years, for some Conservative council somewhere. And it's, you know, he got the job through patronage, such as the scandal of our system of the upper house of all just, you know, mates and donors of whoever's the prime minister and other party leaders are. So he's there because he's Buggins' mate. He's not even been elected or anything. Fortunately, he sounds like a sensible bod. He's electrical engineer or some sort of engineering background, and he worked in a brewery for his career. So sounds like my sort of man, practical and makes beer.
Yes, indeed. Yes. One little aside, which I noticed, was actually a story that you posted, I believe last week, about a specialist contractor that specialises in heritage restoration jobs, a DBR.
DBR, they're a wonderful company.
Yeah, they've been in the news a little bit over the last year or so. They've done some very interesting work. I might take a closer look at them at one point. It's an interesting area, I think. But anyway, no, DBR, they got a royal warrant, I think, the day before the Queen died or 2 days before. But turns out that royal warrants are personally issued by the sovereign and only by the sovereign. You don't carry them over. So everybody who has a royal warrant
has to reapply.
Has to reapply. I think they've got about 2 years grace. I think that'll be quite interesting, actually, because, of course, Charles, who is known to have
King Charles,
who is known to have unimpeachable green credentials, I think we'll probably take a close look at some of these companies, the ones that currently have royal warrants, and you probably want to go through them and think,
do I like their buildings?
Not sure I want them to. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think DBR are probably pretty safe, actually, because, you know, they are in a particular way guardians of our heritage. And I think that that's the sort of thing that Charles, who has some very trenchant views on architecture, for example, would appreciate. So I think that they're probably safe. It's just that they've got to do the paperwork all over again.
DBR are the kind of people that do all the, you know, restoration of the carvery and the ornate stuff in places like Buckingham Palace and the Palace of Westminster. I mean, it's high grade stuff that they do, and real crafty stuff.
Yeah, interesting work. Obviously, they're not the only ones. I don't know if they're the only ones with a royal warrant in that particular sector of the industry, but they do some very interesting work. Some of it very high profile. So I'm sure they've richly earned their royal warrant. They're going to have to earn another one now, though. So I thought that was quite an interesting thing. And I hadn't known that about royal warrants. I thought once you had the royal warrant, you know, it was like a kite mark of some sort that you kept it.
Well, on the subject,
but you don't.
We haven't talked about royal warrants before, but I think it's interesting because on this subject, I've just gone into the Royal Warrant Holders Association website, listed under building and construction-y type things. Crown Paints.
Oh, yeah.
DAS.
Appropriately
DAS
enough.
DAS Construction in Llandovery in Carmarthenshire. They are groundwork and building contractors by appointment to HRH, the Prince of Wales. So whether they get an upgrade to the King, I don't know.
Ah, okay.
Darrenth Valley Building Services. They're building service and maintenance engineers to HM the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
DBR London, you just mentioned. EV Bullen are electrical and mechanical engineers and contractors by appointment to the Queen. And it's quite a few. That's just down to D's at the moment.
Oh, right.
There's a whole bunch of them. Hughes Gray, builder's merchant to the Queen.
Okay.
Didn't know that.
No.
JCB, of course.
Of course.
The HM's Queen preferred digger supplier. No, supplier of manufacture of construction and agricultural machinery.
Yeah.
So who else we've got? Penny Hydraulics. Gosh. Lifting equipment supplier.
Okay.
So there's loads of them, actually. You know, perhaps ones we haven't heard of.
No, indeed. Well, have we covered that topic? I mean, obviously, there'll probably be more to say in coming weeks. I don't know whether or not things are going to simmer down or whether there'll still be some stories coming out relating to the change in sovereign. But we've had the change of government as well, which is something which you said at the beginning is, given the fact that the Queen died two days later has been rather overshadowed, but we shouldn't ignore the fact that we've got a new Prime Minister.
Yes.
And a new administration.
So we'll move on from ER to ET.
Indeed.
Elizabeth Truss. What do you make of her?
I don't know what to make of her, actually. I'm pretty underwhelmed so far, actually. I'm not sure I like the cut of her jib, to put it, to use a well-worn phrase. I was hoping for something better. Let's put it that way. I didn't think much of her as foreign secretary. I thought she was, and her quite blatant attempts to try and make herself appear to be the successor of Margaret Thatcher, you know, riding in tanks and all that sort of nonsense, I felt was a little bit cheesy. I don't know. She didn't seem to have many original ideas. And I'm not sure what to make of what she's done so far. I mean, I suppose she hasn't done an awful lot yet, except announced this massive borrowing in order to cut or to cap energy bills for people. Of course, I mean, we've got a huge problem looming with energy prices increasing and winter coming and all the rest of it. But we know about this because it's been talked about for weeks or months now. So she had to do something. And she had to do something fast. So, I mean, I think the only policy I'm currently aware of the new Prime Minister is this plan to cap typical or average energy bills at around £2,500 a year, which apparently is still twice what it was about this time last year. So, you know, we're all going to have to sort of delve deeper to pay to heat our homes. The price cap was due to go up next month in October to about £3,500. So she's shaved £1,000 off that. Of course, should add the caveat that doesn't mean that you won't pay more than £2,500 for your energy bills next year. It depends on how much you use. I mean, the unit price will be reduced, but not the absolute amount that you pay. If you use more energy, you'll pay more. But this is the average. But I heard somebody from the Institute of Fiscal Studies talking about this very recently, a man called Paul Johnson. I don't know what he does there. He might be the chief executive. He was quite concerned, I think, that in actual fact, although Liz Truss has announced that she's going to borrow billions of pounds in order to fund this scheme, she hasn't even bothered to produce, or hasn't been able to produce, an estimate of how much it will cost in total. And one of the problems is that she maybe can't do that because energy costs depend upon the wholesale price of energy. And she can't control that. And they have been going up and they could continue to go up. So we're assuming that this price cap will deal with the current increase in wholesale energy prices, but it might not be enough to head off further increases in energy prices. And so she's announced this massive increase in spending, but we don't know where it'll end. And that's the thing which is worrying me, I think, that there doesn't seem to be any control. She can't stop it getting any higher if that's what the energy market means. And in fact, this chap, Paul Johnson at the IFS, was saying that it's probably the biggest financial event of our lifetime, and even more so than Rishi Sunak's furlough scheme, which, you know, meant that people could be paid 80% of their wages for not going to work. And when you think about it, I mean, 2 years ago, that seemed ridiculous and it was going to really bankrupt the country. But it didn't, but we did. It did push us further into debt. This is going to push us even further into debt by an even greater margin. So somebody's got to pay, and I imagine that eventually it will be the taxpayers. It will be you and me paying, or our children.
Well, there is no one else, as we always say. When the state gives us money, it's giving us our money.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, it's borrowing. Who does a government borrow from,
by the way? Oh, you're getting all complicated there. it used to have gilts and it could borrow against them on the international markets. And we used to have lots of gold that we could borrow against. But Gordon Brown sold all the gold just before he left office.
So we're up to our necks in debt. We don't know how much debt it's going to be when the final reckoning comes. But we do know that we'll be the ones who pay for it eventually, us and our descendants. So it doesn't look good from my point of view. What do you think about Liz Truss? Do you think she's got anything going for her?
I was quite a Rishi Sunak fan. I thought he was imaginative, creative, intelligent, and I liked the cut of his jib. When he came out, I mean, the furlough scheme, when he came out with Help Out to Eat Out, I thought, that's not what chancellors do. Okay, some people say, well, it spread COVID, it was a super spreading event. But the whole Help Out to Eat Out thing, I just thought, it's just imaginative and creative. And I liked him. And then he completely blotted his copybook during the leadership election campaign, where he told the Tunbridge Wells Garden Party that they should vote for him because I diverted money from, you know, lefty northern inner cities and places like Liverpool to places like Tunbridge Wells because you're more important. And I thought, hang on, he didn't really say that. I might have read it in the Guardian. I don't believe that. And then there was actually video footage, I think, of him saying it. He actually did. Yeah. And I kind of thought, oh, blimey, hang on, you know. Shattered my views of him. It didn't raise my views of Liz Truss particularly, and I know people who have worked with Liz Truss, and I've not heard good things about her from people who have worked with her. So I start off sort of being not particularly sympathetic, but then I stop and think, and I am just about old enough to remember all the same kind of negative attitudes that everyone had about Margaret Thatcher when she became leader of the Conservative Party initially, that, okay, we never had a woman party leader before, never had a woman prime minister, but there's an awful lot of snobbery and chauvinism, frankly, about Margaret Thatcher, that she wasn't quite the right type, kind of thing. And I kind of feel there's a lot of that about Liz Truss. A lot of people think, well, she just, because she's sort of awkward, this is a woman who, you know, went from a state school to Oxford to study maths, or was it Cambridge to study maths. You need a certain brain to be able to get into one of those universities to study maths. I mean, to study anything, but particularly maths. Yeah. So she clearly has some mental acuity, has some brain, and maybe I'm trying to get past my prejudices of her apparent gaucheness, yes, and given the benefit of the doubt. And I had a look through all the things, the policies that she said, and that they actually aren't as radical as I was perhaps being given the impression. And by radical, I mean mad, of course. They weren't perhaps as mad as I thought. That a lot of what she's saying, you kind of think, well, that's not unreasonable. The only thing where I do think she could come a cropper is she says she's going to look again at fracking. But she qualifies that, yes, by saying where people want it. You know, if people want fracking, they can have it. Well, that's not unreasonable. If people want fracking, let them have it. I don't think anyone does want it, do they?
Well, I think you're limited in your choice of sites because you can't just frack anywhere. You can only frack where there's shale gas. And that happens to be up in Lancashire, I think, mainly. And as far as I'm aware, people up there certainly don't want it. So, in fact, if that's the case, then what she said is totally meaningless, because maybe you can frack on the Isle of Wight because they don't mind it, but there's no shale gas there. Or you can frack in East Kent, but there's no shale gas there. But you can't frack in Lancashire because they've tried that and they didn't like it. No, I don't know. I think the point, actually, about fracking, what leads us on to her stance on net zero and the whole carbon reduction program.
But she's committed to that. She's still committed to that. She's committed to the net zero by 2050, which is quite surprising, because you think of that whole sort of, you know, Daily Telegraph, anti-woke agenda and all this sort of culture war stuff.
Yeah.
And I've spoken before, there's this kind of a right-wing backlash against the absolutism of net zero. But she has come out quite clearly and said, nope, we're still gunning for this.
Yeah. What has she said about North Sea gas and oil? Because I'm at the back of my mind, I've got this sort of niggling idea that she said that maybe we should start to explore our offshore resources a little bit more. And I'm not talking about wind. I'm talking about fossil fuels. Am I barking up the wrong tree there? Or is she? I thought that she was saying that given the energy crisis, we might need to look at reviving some fossil fuel sources.
Well, I think there's a difference between during the leadership campaign, there were a lot of things and thoughts and ideas attributed to her that she may not actually have said, or she may have said in briefings or guidance or whatever. And a tendency, if a journalist says, you know, oh, do you think we should think again about North Sea assets? And she might well have said, well, we might well need to, or some such. But when I've looked through the actual comments attributed to her, I have not seen that said. I have seen her say, I made a note from the quest, I support fracking in areas where people want it to happen. We need to get on with delivering the small modular nuclear reactors and other pro things. But she said, we haven't been doing enough on renewable energy. She says, I think hydrogen is very important. It does work with natural gas. We can use a lot of the same infrastructure. And I've seen no comment on oil or you know, carry on exploiting natural gas. Not to say it's not going to happen, or who knows what's going to happen with you know, the Ukraine-Russia situation, how long that's going to go on for. No. Don't know. But my point is that my starting point was a right-wing nutter. And actually, I drill it down and go, well, no, I mean, she's not. Maybe not. Maybe it's, you know, playing to the gallery to get the job with perhaps some fruity rhetoric. But she might not be as bad as we are expecting her to be.
I think on green issues, certainly the industry has made some, because of course, as soon as you get a change of government, every trade association and professional body in the industry contributes their two penneth and says what they hope the new administration will do. And a lot of them do say that she needs to ramp up the green agenda. I mean, not surprisingly, the BRE said that they want
BRE, Building Research Establishment.
Sorry, yes, the Building Research Establishment to publish a credible and effective plan to decarbonize the existing built environment. And in fact, I think a lot of that seems to be a theme, because the Federation of Master Builders also said that, you know, the government should produce a national retrofit strategy. And in fact, I suppose long term, we know this because this isn't news, that we have, you know, very leaky buildings and that our buildings are energy inefficient. We need to ramp up the provision of energy saving measures, so insulation and triple glazing and all that lovely expensive energy saving stuff. But long term, it's true. I think if we want to cut our carbon emissions and our energy consumption, then we need to have more efficient buildings, homes and workplaces. And I think probably that's something that the industry is going to be looking for, not just the BRE and the FMB. I think, in fact, I think CIOB, the Chartered Institute of Building, also said more or less the same sort of thing. People want to see, I don't know, an acceleration or a renewed impetus behind measures such as this, because Boris Johnson, and I think Theresa May as well, they also tried to...
You couldn't remember her name then, could you? You had so many.
I couldn't.
You lose track.
You know, there have been attempts to get people to invest in improving the energy efficiency of their homes, for example, and it hasn't worked so far. So we need to do something about that. But other people, you know... Otherwise, it's the usual stuff. They want lower taxes and they want more work, which is quite predictable, of course.
Yes, we want lower taxes and more of other people's money, please.
Yeah, exactly. Getting back to this massive spending plan to get this energy price cap going, I suppose if it is urgent because winter is on its way, it's only a couple of months away, so you have to do something now. If you were to say, right, okay, then we're going to insulate every house in the country and, you know, we'll give people massive grants in order to do this work, that would be great, but it wouldn't be in time for this winter. And that's when the really critical time will be. So I suppose the only thing to do is throw money at it at this point. But I think long term, there's got to be a more measured and long lasting attempt to tackle energy efficiency in buildings. And so I think that that is, I think that is how Liz Truss will be judged by the industry.
Yes, I mean, her survival at the next election lives or dies on how she manages to control the economy, the cost of living crisis, energy bills, all of things which are frankly outside of her control. So it is a it appears to be an impossible task, and therefore at this stage you kind of say there's no way she can win the next election. But let's see, shall we?
I mean, in terms of cutting taxes, who was it? It was the National Federation of Builders said that, you know, that Liz Truss has promised to be a low-tax conservative. So the NFB wants her to roll back the burden on business and give the industry the room to invest in the future. Well, she can't borrow loads of money and reduce taxes because, as we've already said, we're going to have to pay for this borrowing, and it'll have to start now. So I don't see that she's going to reduce taxes.
Well,
at all.
Well, you say that. I think we're expecting a mini budget next week, and there is a promise to scrap the planned rising corporation tax. It's supposed to
it's due
to go up from 19% to 23% in 2023 corporation tax, and apparently that increase is going to be scrapped. So
right, well there we are.
There will be some cuts, or at least less increases. planned rises won't come.
As I said, it's early days. I'm not really sure what to make of the new. I mean, we haven't talked about the other members of the cabinet yet. I mean, who's the construction minister, the housing minister? I don't know.
Well, Department of Business, Enterprise and Industrial Strategy mentioned it's the brewer, Lord Callanan.
He didn't actually
do the brewer. He fixed the brewing machinery, I think. He held the spanner. Who's the new Minister of Housing? Haven't kept up with that yet. I've been too busy watching royal coverage to follow the political coverage closely enough, I think. But we'll come on to that another day, shall we?
Yes, I think so.
Go on, I've got something for you. If you want to talk about something utterly different, well away from it.
Okay.
I ran a piece last week saying, that's quite surprising. See this, Brentford Football Club. Brentford Football Club in the Premier League, it seemed to be.
Yes.
Hard to remember.
Even I knew that.
But it's hard to remember because they're not historically considered a top flight team, not in my lifetime anyway. But they're up there and doing pretty well, top half the table, I think. And they've got plans to do up their training ground in West London. And so they've got rid of all the old huts that they used to get changed in. And they're putting in new temporary buildings. This is a halfway stop, and eventually they hope to have a proper sort of flash modern training centre of excellence that Premier League football clubs expect to have. But what they're getting at the moment is just new temporary buildings, and they're familiar looking, these buildings. We've got a photo of them going in, and they are supplied by a company called Porter Cabin.
We've all heard of them.
A very, very familiar. In fact, the name that is synonymous, I think, to most people, named synonymous with temporary portable buildings.
Yes.
Porter Cabin units are very familiar. We know what they are. And I used the headline, New Porter Cabins for Premier League Brentford.
As you would. Sounds okay to me.
Lo and behold, within not much more of an hour or so of posting this story, the head of communications at Porter Cabin was, thanks for using the release I issued today. Unfortunately, the headline misuses our trademark. As a registered trademark, Porter Cabin cannot be used as a noun, only as an adjective. And I got kind of a warm glow because it was in about my first month, if not even my first week, as a journalist on the construction trade press in 1980. Did I start in 1988? It was, and I hadn't written it, but I saw the letters. A colleague had used the term Porter Cabin in print generically, and in fact the particular building he was referring to had not been supplied or produced by Porter Cabin but another, and this was a very strongly worded lawyer's letter, and I thought, oh, this is awful, a scary lawyer's letter. And over the years, I've as a journalist, I've come to learn that brand names cannot be used willingly. You cannot talk about a JCB when you mean a Komatsu front wheel loader. You cannot talk about a Hoover when you mean a vacuum cleaner, and all these other synonymous things. And Porter Cabin are very strict. But I'm aware that you can't talk about Porter Cabin as a general term for another building, but I never heard before that you couldn't talk about a Porter Cabin, as in it really is a building made by Porter Cabin, a cabin made by Porter Cabin.
Well, this is a thing which puzzled me, because I've also encountered this. I mean, I think it's fair to say that Porter Cabin are uniquely neurotic about this. JCB, as we all know, people talk about if they see a backhoe loader, they'll call it a JCB. You can't stop them doing it. It's just the way people talk about that.
If it's yellow and on the construction side, a lot of people would call it a JCB, even if it's a
well, crane. Exactly, yeah. That's if they're not calling it a bulldozer, which they often do. But no, Porter Cabin is really hot on this. In fact, I think they've got a full-time employee just to protect their brand. And I appreciate that, you know, the brand name has value. The fact that it has become the sort of de facto general term for a relocatable building is perhaps a tribute to the fact that Porter Cabin is, if you like, the original and best. I don't know if they are the original and best, but they're certainly the go-to. So they want to protect their brand, and I perfectly respect that. And I think that it is unacceptable to talk about another company's competitive product and call it a Porter Cabin. That is that is clearly, apart from anything else,
incorrect,
inaccurate, and wrong. Yeah. But to say that you can't describe Porter Cabin's own products as Porter Cabins seems to me to be taking it just a bit too far.
Well, as I replied to Porter Cabin, I said, "Oh, does this mean I can't buy a Ferrari or wear a Rolex? Am I not allowed to wear Levi's?
No.
You know, am I not allowed to have an iPhone? Can I not drink Pepsi or eat a Big Mac? I mean, actually, Big Mac was incorrect. McDonald's is clearly the company. Big Mac is the product. But I do understand their point, that if they don't protect it, if they don't actively, anytime it's misused in print, actively go after it, then after a period of time, anyone will be allowed to use the term Porter Cabin, be allowed to use it with a lowercase p, and it's up to them to protect it, to stop it becoming generified.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a phrase. I had a look at this and I found quite an interesting article, an American article actually, which used the term genericide. And I think that sums it up. You know, and
the brand is killed, is that?
Well, your brand basically ceases to exist. It becomes, you know, I think Hoover. And I mean, there are others as well.
Biro is a famous one. I mean, Biro was a bloke.
Yes, that's right. And Yo-Yo is another one. You know, we see that sort of Diablo thing on a string, and we call it a Yo-Yo. But no, Yo-Yo was a brand name. But the brand died. And the term became a generic. So yes, it's important, and the brand has value. There's another issue. This particular article talked about the fact that, and you will recognize this name, there's a tendency you can use a brand name as a verb as well. And the example they gave is that you can Google Bing, but you can't Bing Google. Do you see what I mean? Google, in fact, was involved in I thought this was fascinating, actually. There was a couple of chancers in America who decided that, you know, because we Google stuff all the time, whenever we do an internet search, we Google it, whatever search engine you use. They had decided quite unilaterally that Google had thus become a generic term. They didn't bother to check whether or not that was a fact, but they just deduced it. And so they tried to register several domain names which combined the word Google with other brand names. And Google didn't like this, obviously, and they took them to court, and Google won. And the judge decided that the term Google had not become a generic and therefore could not be used. But the fact that it's interesting, different people have different perceptions of this issue, because the use of your brand name as a verb is, if you like, as I said about, obviously nobody would portacabin something, that you can't use portacabin as a verb. You can use it as a noun. But the fact that it has become, like JCB, an informal generic used by the great unwashed populace to talk about a particular type of product, that is a sign of your superiority or of your value, the value that people attach to your brand. The interesting, there's a much newer brand, Uber, which a lot of people will know about. Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi, I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, recently acknowledged that Uber was a verb and said that very few brands become verbs. For Uber, it has achieved, to have achieved this shows that we've captured imaginations and become an important part of our customers' lives. So that, if you like, is a complete reverse attitude to porter cabins. Uber sees this as a badge of honour in a way, rather than a devaluation of their brand.
It does work two ways. I mean, if people, when they think of denim jeans, they think of Levi's, more people will buy Levi's over Lee Cooper or any other.
Well, that's right, because Levi's is the preferred brand.
If you start a company and your brand becomes synonymous with the product, you've made it. But on the other hand, if you are this huge entity and everyone's using your name and cashing in on it and trading off it, that's when your descent starts. And the one that comes to mind with me is, when I was growing up, the only people that I knew of as made vacuum cleaners were Hoovers. And Hoover was a vacuum cleaner, and vice versa, just like your point about JCB. And I didn't know anyone else. In fact, did anyone else make vacuum cleaners apart from Hoover in the 70s and 80s? No idea, but they're all Hoovers. until someone came along with a bagless vacuum cleaner, which is completely different, Mr. Dyson, and suddenly you either had a Hoover or a Dyson. Oh, I don't have a Hoover, I have a Dyson. And then everyone started, you know, James Dyson tried to stop other people copying the technology that went into his bagless, and a certain amount was protected, but not the whole concept of a bagless vacuum cleaner. Yeah. And so now we have two generics. There are bagless vacuum cleaners, which are Dysons, whether they're made by Dyson or not.
Yes.
So Hoover make Dyson, but Dyson don't make Hoovers. It's like your Google and Bing analogy.
I think that there's an issue here, which is to do with origination. Relocatable buildings of the porter cabin variety. I don't know, and I'm sure that somebody would be able to correct me very easily, whether or not porter cabin was the first company to produce these. I think if you originate a product, if you invent a product, that product, even after your patents expire and other people can start making similar or very similar products, your name will be forever attached to that generic product type. And I think that's what's happened with porter cabin. If you look at Levi's, for example, we still talk about wearing jeans. It hasn't become a generic. It's become, if you like, a premium brand. You know, Levi's are the premium brand. It's the same with Rolex, for example. Wristwatches existed before Rolex. And so Rolex is a premium brand. It's not the only one, but it is the one. If you ask somebody to talk about, you know, a high-value wristwatch, they'll say a Rolex, almost certainly. And it's the same with other things. Can't think of any at the moment. But,
well, I mentioned, you know, I think that Ferraris and Rollers and Jags.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And so, people like Levi's and Rolex have the luxury of being the premium brand, but without people talking about, you wouldn't call a Patek Philippe a Rolex, because it patently isn't. You know, it's an even more expensive wristwatch, but, you know, the Rolex is the name to conjure with.
Yes, yes. But what was interesting about the porter cabin, actually sent me a document saying, we're here to help. Here's our trademark guidance. And it was implying that this is a law, you have to do this to stay legal.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that it is incorrect. I don't know if it's illegal to call a Dyson a Hoover, but it's wrong.
Yeah.
But So I don't mind Porter Cabin saying, oh, that building you said was a Porter Cabin is actually an Elliot or a Bloggs or some mm-hmm. other building. It's not one of ours. Fine, that's correct. But to say you cannot talk about our buildings as Porter Cabins, you cannot use our name as a noun, it's only an adjective, that's a different thing altogether. That's what you and I as journalists are very familiar with, the concept of house style. So if you're within Porter Cabin, you're saying this is how we use Porter Cabin. A lot of organisations say that, you know, our house style is that we must write our company name in capital letters, uppercase.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I love, I remember reading one company's house style, and it was explaining the correct job titles, and that's fair enough. Is the boss, you know, the managing director or the chief executive? Is he or she the chief executive or the chief executive officer? And it doesn't matter externally what they're called, but internally you should all, you know, be consistent.
Sure.
But this organization insisted that internally, and they tried to do it externally, important people in the organization, their job titles were uppercase. Chief executive, big C, big E. Chief executive, David Taylor. And chief financial officer, big C, big F, big O, David Taylor, until you got to a certain level. It might have been site manager, then it was little s, little m. So they actually decided, it's a bit like who can use the executive bathroom. If you can use the executive bathroom, you have capital letters because you're important.
Yeah.
And this idea of, you know, uppercasing job titles, ludicrous. So, yes, don't confuse house style with the law.
I think that the thing about using a brand name as a noun being a no-no is just going a little bit too far. I wouldn't dream of calling somebody else's site cabin a Porter Cabin if it wasn't a Porter Cabin, because I would then be misleading my readers. I'd be giving them false information. But to tell me that I cannot call one of Porter Cabin's site cabins a Porter Cabin is something up with which I will not put. You know, it's trying to control somebody else's use of language. And it reminds me of who's that Canadian psychologist who became very, very well known a couple of years ago because he very vocally objected to the Canadian government's proposed law that would have made it illegal to refer to somebody by pronouns other than those that they had chosen themselves. And he said, you're not going to tell me how to use my language. I have sympathy with him there, because I think that the language isn't something that you... It's a way of trying to control somebody by trying to make them speak in a certain way, and I don't think that's right. You know, if you were to say, for example, talking about a plant hire company that, you know, they're a loyal JCB company, you know, customer, and they buy all their equipment from JCB, you'd say their entire fleet are JCBs. You wouldn't say their entire fleet is JCB backhoe loaders, 360-degree excavators, mini excavators, front loaders, all the rest of it. You wouldn't go through the whole gamut. You'd say their entire fleet is JCBs.
Hang on,
what's wrong with that?
But I tell you what's wrong with that, because going on to your point about genericization, to me, if someone is generically talking about a JCB, I think. They don't mean any old piece of construction machinery. They actually mean a backhoe loader, even though...
Okay.
Because JCB is synonymous with a backhoe loader. It is not synonymous. Loadall is synonymous with the JCB brand. It's synonymous with telehandlers. Yeah. But I don't think JCB is synonymous with any machine apart from a backhoe loader, even though they make lots of other machines. So
true.
If someone said to me their entire fleet are JCBs, I'd think they only had, they might mean, I'd need clarification, they might mean their entire fleet is purely made up of backhoe loaders made by JCB. Whereas if they said their entire fleet is completely JCB produced or JCB supplied or JCB manufactured, I'd be okay. I'd be clearer on that.
And that would satisfy the trademark people, because we'd be using JCB
as an adjective. Well, Porter Cabin, of course, as we use it incorrectly, make things other than Porter Cabins, because they also make big building hospitals and things too, don't they? Things which you don't think of as a Porter Cabin.
Still, I mean, I don't think any of our listeners should worry that if they're out on site and they direct somebody to go and see the site manager in the porter cabin, that they're going to get slapped with a writ for misusing that particular brand name.
But porter cabin don't care about that. They don't care about you and I using incorrectly in dialogue.
No.
It's when it becomes written down.
Yes.
It's the written word which then gets words and terminology eventually translated into the dictionary. And once it appears in the dictionary with a small p,
yeah,
you've lost it.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Exactly. It's interesting, as I said, that you know, porter cabin are totally.
I feel I'm more sympathetic to them than you are here, David.
Yeah, I think you probably are. I just think there's something about the fact that they are so fanatical about it that makes me. I don't know. It makes the sort of the mischievous part of me want to goad them whenever I get the chance. I wouldn't, of course. That'd be very unprofessional. But I mean, when somebody cares about something so much, you just want to sort of poke them a little bit and say, you know, get off your high horse. I mean, JCB it doesn't do this. I mean, I'm sure that they are aware of their brand value and they police it pretty well, but they're not to the quite the same extent.
I mean, JCB as a brand, I think is probably worth many times more what Porter Cabin is worth as a brand. But JCB has other assets. It has intellectual property, as we've seen in recent litigation it's been having against the French telehandler manufacturer. Porter Cabin, I don't know this for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if it had no intellectual property left. The product is more generic than a JCB product, I believe.
Sure.
The name is the most special thing, the most valuable thing it has. It's incumbent upon it to protect it. If I was a shareholder, I'm not, it's family owned, it's the Shepherd family, I think still own it, don't they? But if I was a shareholder of Porter Cabin, I would demand that they continue to protect that brand name because that was, you know, that's shareholder interest.
Yes.
So, yeah. All power to them.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Right. I'm off to my Porter Cabin now.
Do you know what? I have to say, throughout this conversation, apart from Elliot, I haven't been able to think of another brand name in that sector. That's rather telling, isn't it? I mean, I know that Porter Cabin have swallowed up one or two of their competitors in recent years, but off the top of my head, I can't think of any others.
Do you know, this is quite interesting. You talked about Google earlier. I just thought Porter Cabin Makers, I put into Google to see if it gave, put a lowercase p, to see if it gave a list of other prefab modular building suppliers. First page, pure, proper Porter Cabin. There's no one else muscling in. As far as Google is concerned, no one is muscling in on Porter Cabin with a capital P. So they that shows how successful they are at protecting their name. If you Google Porter Cabin, you will only get Porter Cabin.
Right, okay.
Right, David, I think I'm looking at the clock and we have gone on far too long.
Yeah, far too long, yes.
Just to remind listeners that we have a podcast email address, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. I realise that a lot of people regard email as old and we should be saying TikTok us or Twitter us or whatever. But David and I are both of an age where we find email perfectly modern enough, thank you. So send us an email, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk, with your views on any of the things we've been talking about. We're also interested to hear what your company's attitude is, your organisation's attitude is to the bank holiday on Monday the 19th of September. Are you all getting the day off work? So that you can behave appropriately for the day of the Queen's funeral and commemorate her life and her reign. So podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Get in touch, give us your thoughts, give us your feedback. But for another week, thank you very much for listening to me, Phil Bishop, and him, David Taylor.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.